Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
There's been a lot of professors and doctors linking up with OCAP in this fight for the special diet. Quite a few known, reputed doctors and professors, one being Dennis Rafael. He is a PhD associate professor at the School of Health and Policy Management, Atkinson Faculty, York University. It goes on and on. If you go to the OCAP site, you're going to find tons of information that's useful. Some of the information there is about doctors so that they can have a tip sheet. And some of it is showing how many of the doctors are getting behind this special diet campaign. We interviewed Dennis Rafael. We wanted to ask him his opinion on Sandra Pupatello's 180 about face when it came to giving more money to the poor.
Dennis Rafael, I'm an associate professor at the School of Health Policy and Management at York University in Toronto.
And you're also involved with?
I've been editor of a book called Social Determinants of Health, which was able to bring together a whole range of sectors that are concerned with health and well-being. And I consult with a variety of organizations and agencies that are concerned about income, poverty, and public policy.
Okay, so what we're talking about today on the phone with Dennis is the October the 3rd OCAP mass special diet rally in front of Queen's Park, and the reaction from Sandra Pupatello's office, or a lack of reaction, except that to say or give hints that she's going to find ways to stop people from getting this special diet. And one of the things that we were just discussing, Dennis was mentioning the obvious facts of all politicians will say one thing before election and another thing after election, but Sandra Pupatello was the critic for when the Tories were in power, and she's done a complete about-face.
The Toronto Star, she was quoted as saying, I'm not going to let the law be manipulated, abused by rogue advocates.
Yeah, she's been saying that a lot. She actually, her assistant told me when I called on Tuesday, they keep playing out that line that doctors have been threatened, but that's a farce. I mean,
No, the whole thing is, there's been a whole series of letters to the Toronto Star, one of which was from an executive director of a community health center that said that Pupatello was a hypocrite because she had been courting all of these so-called rogue advocate groups while she was in opposition. And I went to a presentation she gave to a faith community, ISOC, Interfaith Alliance for Social Assistance Reform. And the first words out of her mouth was, lay off me, I'm doing everything I can, give us time. She's a very aggressive woman. And basically, she does what they all do. I mean, whether it's that or the clawback, I could talk about all of this. They all point out how terrible the cutbacks in social assistance was of 22%.
Until they get elected.
Yeah, now 10 years later, they've restored it by 3%, not taking into account all of the subsequent deterioration in cost of living.
It's a repeated show.
Well, let me give you a little bit even more of a background. Gerard Kennedy, about 8-9 years ago, was formerly director of the Daily Bread Food Bank in Toronto. And I had invited him to come address some medical students I was teaching at the University of Toronto. And what he told these medical students was that the reason he went into politics, because he had seen the conservative government at a stroke of a pen wipe out 10 years of good work he had done. And he was referring to the 22% cut in social assistance benefits in Ontario. Now, during that time of opposition, especially Sandra Pupatello, among others, was constantly railing against a number of policies, the cutbacks in social assistance, the failure to raise the minimum wage, the clawback of the federal child benefit. Federal child benefit is the federal government reading some of the research literature and deciding the last thing you want to do is have poor families with poor children, allocated that low-income families would receive approximately $200 a month. The provinces demanded that they have the ability to what's called claw back this benefit for those who are on social assistance. So if you happen to be earning minimum wage and making $18,000 a year and have a child, you would get $200 a month. If, on the other hand, you are on social assistance and getting significantly less than that, let's say $12,000 to $13,000 or $14,000, you would not be entitled to a single penny of that. The province would claw it back. Ontario was one of the provinces that claws it back, and during the election campaign, McGuinty promised that they would end that. They would not keep this money out of the most vulnerable families.
Now they're saying it's too hard to remove.
The election came in, and now McGuinty announced that they're not going to do that. They raised social assistance benefits by 3%, which, again, is not close to the 22% that it was cut by, nor any of the additional cost of living. And they've raised the minimum wage by a meager amount. The most exciting thing, I've been spending the last 8 to 10 years trying to get public health and other public agencies to be concerned about these issues. And what OCAP did was, well, they found a provision that simply pointed out that a healthcare professional could, on the basis of a person's situation and health situation, allocate a special diet supplement of approximately, I believe it's $250 a month.
Yeah, maximum, no matter what.
So what happened was, and this was pretty exciting, real healthcare professionals who had MDs after their names and RN, and dietitians basically said, well, living in poverty is well established as a health condition, and the last thing you want to be doing when you're raising children is to have them hungry or stressed out or potentially homeless. And they basically, as which is not completely unknown, identified the state of material deprivation that people on social assistance live on as being a medical condition and began to allocate this money for those people who are indeed in desperate straits by virtue of living on social assistance. The reaction, first from the city of Toronto, and it may very well be other cities across the province, was one of real, literally, rage and anger. You know, how dare they do this? First, the city of Toronto enacted a whole series of draconian regulations that were quickly reversed by popular pressure. First of all, they said only an MD could do this, and the actual legislation says no. A registered dietitian or a registered nurse could do this. So they backed off, and then the Toronto Board of Health endorsed the whole program. So now you have the city of Toronto more or less backing off. What's happened now is the province has now taken this very aggressive stance, such that Pupatello is now talking about rogue advocates of abuse of the law. Rogue advocates, it's the Daily Bread Food Bank, it's a number of community health centers, it's a number of well-known advocacy organizations. So this is another example of, I don't know how you would call it, the thing that is the most troubling is that on one hand, McGuinty et al. Will all announce a new Ministry of Health Promotion, and everybody goes on to profess how concerned they are about the health of Canadians or Ontarians. And yet it's well established that the single best predictor of any number of diseases, illnesses, disorders is living under conditions of material deprivation. So now that governments are being provided with an opportunity legally in a reasonable way to meet the needs of the most marginalized and people living under conditions of social deprivation, especially children, their reaction is to hit back, and to hit back very aggressively, such a manner as to denounce these organizations that are trying to deal with people that are living under the most stress and most difficult living conditions.
What do you think, Dennis? Do you think the Pupatello is stalling till they can rewrite the legislature?
They can do whatever they want. They have a majority government. They can do whatever they want. I think that there's been a nice series of letters in the Star. There was 4 letters so far. I haven't looked today. There was a column. On Monday, there's going to be an op-ed piece written by a professor of nutrition from Queen's University, talking about Thanksgiving and how many people in Canada and probably Toronto are hungry. And I'm not sure she links it directly to the food supplement campaign, but certainly it's obvious.
So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the I don't know how many doctors were at Monday, the October 3rd OCAP rally, but it was surprising to me and very good to see that a lot of the doctors were there signing the forms.
People are out there. Some of them are more out there than others. It's well known that community health centers throughout the province have been certainly more visible and more in the forefront. There's a long-standing group called the Medical Reform Group that has long advocated for progressive public policy. But I'll tell you, I was surprised. I was surprised when this campaign not only got started, but that some of the people that were actually in the forefront were family physicians and MDs, some of which work at St. Michael's Hospital. At the OCAP website, there's a list of health professionals that have signed on to this, and some of them are really well known and well respected. That's a surprise. I mean, it's great, and it's really reassuring to see it.
Can you mention some of those names for the benefit of some of the...
Well, Steve Wong, who's a major homelessness researcher, is on the list. Phil Berger, who's the director of family medicine at St. Michael's Hospital. Certainly a range of executive directors of community health centers in Toronto. Some professors are on it. Certainly I'm on it. And other MDs are on it. I'm aware of Gary Bloke from St. Mike's and Phil Berger and any number of registered nurses.
That's fine. I can get that list. Now, is there any kind of a backup plan by yourself or anybody that you're going
to
be...
Well, I'm peripheral to this. I've provided them with information, background information. They used a lot of my papers and reports that I've written on poverty and health. I had the opportunity to speak at a press conference they had in downtown. But no, this is something that I'm following with interest and doing what I can to help, but certainly not a leader or an organizer for this.
So what would you like to say to some of the doctors out there that are hesitating when it comes to filling out these special diet forms?
There's always a threat. I mean, there's always a threat in everything we do. I think, I don't know what to say. I mean, you do what is right. You realize you're not the only one. You realize that thousands of people have been signed up for this. And I think it's unlikely they're going to do anything that is really going to be a threat to any of our well-being. But ultimately, it's always an individual decision. Governments have the opportunity to monitor and to, in theory, propose sanctions. So I think the most important thing they can do is follow closely what's going on. And if they're concerned about it, to go to the list at OCAP and look at some of the pretty high-profile physicians that are on this list and speak with them.
One of the other questions that has to be brought to the forefront of social consciousness is how much more money it's going to cost medically for not supplying this diet.
Well, you know, governments have no trouble with spending millions and millions of dollars in so-called anti-tobacco initiatives. There's so much floating around in the province of Ontario, for example, that public health units are doing somersaults to think of what they consider are creative and innovative ways. The Toronto Public Health Unit is now advertising for program managers to spend money associated with anti-tobacco programs among gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth. I would argue that for gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth, their potential use of tobacco is probably the least of the issues they face nowadays. But the money is being thrown at these public health units to do it. So again, what I would suggest is that there's certainly money available to meet the needs of these people. In the meantime, however, governments seem to have no awareness that when you create hungry children and stressed out families, you're basically producing people that are not only going to show health issues early in life, but there's a tremendous amount of evidence that indicates that living under difficult conditions as a child are the best predictors, excellent predictors of whether people develop cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and respiratory problems as adults and as elderly.
Dennis Raphael and the doctors he's talking about aren't the only predictors of this health problem down the road. At a recent presentation to City Hall by the Round Table on Poverty, Paul Johnson also pointed out that starving kids now means more health problems throughout their life.
This is a wonderful quote that Dr. Fraser Mustard uses in his presentations, and I've lifted it to put it in here. Because Best Start is also about poverty reduction, and we need to understand that. We know from studies that there are higher rates of poverty among adults with low literacy skills. We also know that the foundations for literacy begin in the early years. This is about economic development. James Heckman didn't write this quote because he's a bleeding heart liberal. He wrote it because he understands the importance of developing human capital as we move towards a more knowledge-based economy. The risks for failing to make investments in children are quite severe on an economic side. Best Start is also about health. We know that health problems related to early life and brain development include coronary heart disease, non-insulin dependent diabetes, obesity, mental health, and blood pressure. Heckman's chart shows that as we move through to adulthood, really the return on investment is dollar for dollar. But in those early years, there is a much stronger return on investment in our community.
And now back to Dennis Raphael.
Canada actually has one of the highest rates of spending on medical care. And knowing what we know about how they treat a significant proportion of people, that's not surprising. I mean, when you got in Toronto, we have something like 37, 39% of families living under the low-income cutoffs. And with the hundreds of thousands of people across the province that are using food bags, it's not particularly surprising that people are becoming sick and ill, either as children or as adults, at much higher rates than other countries where people are better taken care of.
Not to mention the homeless and the cost of taking care of them.
I mean, the governments and cities have no problems with hiring people to provide shelter, to get people to use condoms, not to smoke, to fight chlamydia, not get their heads cracked open riding bicycles, and about the number of programs that are being established, when the solution to an awful lot of these issues is to basically provide people with more economic resources. So you don't have to have breakfast programs. People can buy their own Cheerios.
Yeah, I was just going to say the breakfast programs in schools and what they go on about, you know, having children with a full belly so they can learn.
Issues with these breakfast programs. Some researchers have been calling them feeding programs. And what they basically do is they convey the image that low-income families are incapable of taking care of children. What it does, if you think how important breakfast and meals are to the concept of family solidarity, what you're basically communicating not only to these low-income families, but also to the school professionals and to the public in general, is that these people are incapable of being decent parents. So instead of hiring middle-class nurses or middle-class program managers to set up tables and hand Cheerios out to people, I'd rather just give the $5 a week to the low-income family so they can go out and make their own breakfast. You know, if people don't have enough money to feed their children, then the solution is not to set up tables in schools, but to make sure they have enough money to make their own breakfast.
Exactly. It's so obvious. It should be so a no-brainer, but it's, you know, the propaganda tool.
Oh, it goes on and on. I mean, the thing that really gets me angry, and it should get your listeners angry, is this clawback. This clawback. What happens is the province takes this $200 a month that would go to people on social assistance, takes the money, but then resolves to spend it on programs. So what they do is they take the money out of low-income families' budget. They then use that money to hire public health nurses to set up parenting centers. So what you do is you take the money out of poor people's pockets, force them to use food bags, force them to have children living under conditions of profound stress, and then you urge them to go down the street and be told by some middle-class professional how to be a good parent.
Exactly. Well, every city has their own control over that to some extent with their 20% of the funds, don't they?
Yes, they have control. My understanding is that there's been, in the case of certainly Peterborough, certainly Kingston, and I'm not sure whether this is the case in Hamilton or not, the city has some control over the clawback and how it will be allocated. And I know in Kingston and Peterborough, significant effort has been made to put that money back in the pockets of the people from whom it's being taken.
Do you know how they're doing it?
No, I don't. No, this came up at a meeting yesterday.
Okay, I do know London's got a very good program through the Big Brothers and Big Sisters. They found a way around what the problem you're talking about. Hamilton?
Yeah. Hamilton is not one of the better examples.
No, it's still struggling and still, you know, they've got so many pockets already being filled by this money that they say they're having a really hard time stopping these programs because they benefit those that are making minimum wage.
Well, anyway, but again, you know, I mean, think about it. You're on social assistance. The federal government in its wisdom says, you know, the last thing you want to do is have these people suffering. We offer you $200 a month, and the city or the province or whatever says, no, you're not entitled to that. We're going to take it and set up a program for you. We basically go to rich people and say, we're going to take $10,000 off your top of your income and use it to provide you with an empathy and sensitivity program so you'll be more concerned about issues to the public as general. Think what the reaction would be from the wealthy.
It's a good analogy.
Yeah.
It's a good analogy. And the thing that really gets me angry is that this goes on decade after decade, and it's kids. You know, the kids always end up being the ones that pay, no matter who the parent is.
Well, yeah, and then when you add on top of all of this the obsession with tobacco, the obsession with obesity, the obsession with fat and eating fat, I mean, the hypocrisy of it for these governments and for public health units, I would add, to come out and say, we're concerned about health, we're concerned about the sustainability of the healthcare system, we're concerned about all of this, yet to absolutely ignore these issues. I mean, if your readers were to go to any particular website of a public health unit, and it probably includes Hamilton as well, what you'll see is tobacco, diet, activity.
Yeah.
It may very well be the city of Hamilton's doing good stuff, but I would probably, it's an empirical question. Look to see how much involvement the Hamilton Public Health Unit has with these kinds of initiatives, for example.
Well, there's such an industry being always made off the poor. It's going on for hundreds of years.
Well, it's worse. It gets worse. It ebbs and it flows. One could make the argument that probably during the Davis era, people were not being treated as poorly as they're being treated now.
Well,
I mean, not that everything was great and hunky-dory, but certainly we didn't have the food banks. We didn't have people tripping over each other because they're sleeping on the street. I mean, it certainly wasn't a golden era of Ontario, but certainly we didn't have the kind of a concentration of poverty, the homelessness, the food banks that we seem to be having now.
It's been like that for like 10 or 12 years.
Well, the Davis era ended, what, in 1987 or so. So, yeah, it's been almost 20 years now.
And it's just amazing how people can still be immune to what they see, like you say, tripping over people on the
street. You know, I don't think the problem is Canadians. We just did a study. We did four neighborhoods in Toronto, four neighborhoods in Edmonton, and it's consistent with a whole range of research where basically we found that something like 75-80% of Canadians in these eight communities, even in Alberta, will agree with the statement that government policies have helped create more poor people. Only 25% of our raw population, which again is consistent with studies in general, will say that the poor are lazy. The poor are poor because they're lazy. Overwhelmingly, the average Canadian has what we call a structural analysis to poverty, that they recognize that people are poor through no fault of their own. The problem is not the public. I think the problem are the leadership. That basically the leadership, the elected politicians, and I would argue the healthcare communities and the public health communities have been really, really bad laggards on any of this. Having said all that, the Ontario Public Health Association conference coming up in Toronto in November has a main theme of how do we begin to address these issues, or what they call the determinants of health. So there's some hope, but they certainly have a far way to go. Public health, for example, and the healthcare community has not been in the forefront of these issues. So that's why it's kind of reassuring and exciting to see some of the healthcare professionals involved in the OCAP initiative.
Can you give a little bit more information about that conference in November? Where and when?
And I'll say this very slowly. If people go to www.o, P as in Peter, H as in hot, A as in apple, .on.ca. That's the website of the Ontario Public Health Association. And once you get there, click on conference. What you'll see is they have this major public health conference coming up. And they've invited Professor David Gordon, who's director of the Peter Townsend Center for Poverty and Exclusion, to address the group on basically what public health could be doing to be addressing these kinds of issues.
What about this global thing that's been going on with the musicians to make poverty history?
Stuff's going on. I'm not, quite honestly, I'm more focused on Ontario and Canada. Global health is a whole other thing. There is some very, very good work done. I mean, you think that the situation in Canada is bad. If you were to become aware of some of the things that have been getting done to the developing world in terms of free trade agreements or economic restructuring, there's a new book that's available on a website. The website is the Center for Social Justice website, which www.socialjustice.org.
Yeah.
And it's a book by Ron Labonte, which is called Health for Some. And it's downloadable free. And that stuff, I mean, you take the situation we have here and you just magnify it about 300 times and you have the situation of what's happening in the developing world.
I'm glad you brought that up because all of this is related to globalization and free trade.
Gary Teeple, who is a political economist at Simon Fraser University, wrote a remarkable book. Teeple is T-E-E-P-L-E, and it's called Globalization and the Decline of Social Reform. And he argues that at the end of World War II, the reason you had the development of a strong welfare state was you had strong national identities that supported strong national unions, such that Levi's had to negotiate with his union because its factories were in Illinois, and if they had a strike, they had no money. What's happened during the 60s and especially during the 70s is because of globalization, national identities and the ability of national governments to create policy have been very much weakened. But even more importantly, national unions have become weakened, such that anybody who's been alert the last 10 years would realize that everything got up and left here, first went to Mexico, then moved to Thailand and India, and now everything is in China now. Absolutely everything seems to be getting made in China. So the ability of workers to argue or influence or negotiate for decent benefits, higher wages, is tremendously weakened because the union movement is being weakened.
Yeah, not to mention water and air in third world countries like Venezuela, Colombia.
I mean, where to begin? What I've decided to do is to at least... I mean, in terms of my day-to-day work, which is focused on Canada, and that is to basically say to people, look, this is not what we should be doing, and if you're so concerned about health, and if you're so concerned about social breakdown, and if you're so concerned about all of this, the solution is right and you know, obvious. And it's not as if there's no resources available. I mean, the gross domestic product, the total of all of our goods and services, has never been higher. There's never been more money available. There's never been more wealth available.
It's just not staying here.
Well, it's staying here, but it's going to the people on the top.
Yeah, corporate CEOs are getting a killing.
Not only that. I mean, if you look at some of the census data for wealthy Canadians, the average wealthy Canadian made $120,000 in 1991, and now they're making $14,000 more. When for the bottom 10% of the population, the average income might have been $13,000, and it hasn't moved. So there's never been more money available. It's just accruing to people at the top, in addition to what might be getting sent off to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Already, we can see profound deterioration, especially in the city of Toronto. I mean, to the point where, you know, now people have to be worried about getting hit by stray bullets. And this stuff doesn't happen by accident. I mean, anybody's taken introduction to anything, whether it's criminology or introduction to sociologists, this stuff is as obvious as the end of your nose.
What would you like to say to Ontarians? Or
the very minimum, but you know, write letters to the editor, write letters to Pupatello. Basically, call up your MP and your MPP and say this is not acceptable. And you'd be amazed how few people do this. Virtually nobody. Nobody seems able to click on an email link and send an email to Pupatello or send an email to their federal representative. It's quite remarkable how little people do, even the people you would think would be the most concerned about this.
And that's it for this week. We will continue to follow this OCAP story and keep you posted as to what's going on with the legislature, trying to get an interview with Sandra Pupitello, but we haven't had much luck. Take care. Have a good week. Coming up next week, we'll be talking about water and how it affects our health. Redefining radio.